Welcome back to the Unbox Broadcast. It's Women's History Month, and today Dr. Davis and I take a personal journey discussing our own struggles with male chauvinism. We're ready to dive in. We're excited you're here. So stick around as we help you unbox the power and potential of your leadership.
I'm Dr. Robert Davis, family life educator and leadership coach. This is my co-host, R.P. Soriano. Soriano attended Johns Hopkins Carey Business School, worked in the financial industry, and was an international consultant before partnering with me to launch Unbox to Lead. Me? Well, I worked for over 20 years as a senior pastor and a community organizer. Then I retired and started a leader's peer support community called Unbox to Lead. Soriano and I have been friends since the early 90s, and with our varied experiences and expertise, we help leaders reach the next level in their leadership. So join us for the next few moments as we unbox the power and the potential of your relationships, your leadership, and your life.
Welcome back, one and all, wherever in the world you may be. I'm R.P. Soriano, and with me once again is Dr. Robert Davis. He's a family life and relationship expert, an author, speaker, activist, and my best friend. Dr. Robert Davis, how are you doing, man? How's your week been? Welcome back.
Man, it has been wonderful, and I'm just going to jump right into this, man. I am nervous about this subject, and I don't usually get nervous about many subjects. This just seems like when I decide to run for the chairman of the United Nations, that this is going to be the thing that comes back to haunt me. I hope it doesn't.
Yeah, I definitely feel like we are putting ourselves on blast, as they say, as the kids say, or I don't think the kids say that anymore. But whoever says that, we're putting ourselves in a position where we have to kind of navigate a minefield here. But I do want to ask our audience, you know, to please be gracious and patient with us. We are really going to try to take an introspective look at our own struggles with male chauvinism, toxic masculinity, and all of those things that have just been baked into our experience as we've grown up. And we are middle aged now. And so we come from a place in time where, this is just kind of a part of our DNA, but we've evolved, we've grown, we've developed, and we're at a different place, thankfully, in our lives. And so we just want to have that conversation between the two of us about that, given that it's Women's History Month. And we could easily start off, you know, kind of pandering and talking about, women's contributions in society, which we will save for the pandering part. But we will have those discussions and we will have great interviews in future shows. But we thought we really need to get right to the meat of this and talk about what the problem is. And we knowingly or unknowingly have been part of the problem ourselves. So we want to remind everyone before we jump in to like, share, and subscribe to the broadcast. And just a quick update on our BIPOC scholarship program that we're doing, the BIPOC Leaders Peer Support Community. We have received a lot, an overwhelming amount of applications to this program that we are really going to have to be pouring through. The deadline is March the 8th. We've been thinking that we need to cut the deadline sooner, but we don't want to turn anyone away. And we do want to try to make sure that we get the people something, even if we exceed the amount of slots that are available. The cohort does begin on March 28th. And like I said, the last time to apply is March 8th. You can visit our website, www.unboxtolead.com/scholarship, where you can apply and learn more there. Okay, are we ready?
Let me just share something real good with our listeners and viewers. Okay. And that is, if you apply and you do qualify, which means that you are a BIPOC leader of a nonprofit or community organization, then while we are not going to be able to accept everyone under this into the entire membership of Unbox to Lead, we are going to be planning some very special kind of, I guess you can call it, consolation prizes that we believe will be a great benefit to your leadership and helping you as you grow and as you create a calm, less anxious, more positive workplace culture. So we are going to have some things. Anyone who applies will receive, if you meet the qualifications, you will receive something from Unbox to Lead. That's our guarantee to you.
All right, fantastic. All right, let's go ahead and dive right in. We are talking about, give me one. Sorry about that. So we are diving into a very sensitive subject, and we're just gonna dive right in. And I'm gonna start asking some questions, Robert. You're gonna kind of talk through them, and then we'll just have a conversation about it. So let's kind of get to the meat of this. Let me ask you first to describe the world and the family structure that you were born into, and how that may have or may not have contributed to kind of a chauvinistic viewpoint.
Yeah, my mother and father remarried 2 years ago, but I have no memory of them being married when I was a child. They legally divorced when I was 6 years old, but I don't ever remember them actually living together as husband and wife. So I was raised in a single parent home. And as I tell a lot of people, at the time, my father did not know how to manage a relationship with my mother, manage his life, and then also be active in our lives. He just didn't. That was not a resource that he had available to him at the time. So I was raised in a single parent home with just my mother. We were raised primarily in the inner cities of Washington, D.C., Southeast Washington, D.C., to be more exact. So, I was surrounded by poverty. Then, of course, the mid-80s came, and so I was surrounded by crime. I tell people, just as it relates to the time I was born into, that, I came into the world in the 70s. I became self-aware in the 80s. I came of age in the 90s, and I became an adult, a real, real adult in the 2000s. And so that's kind of like the world that I've experienced and that shaped and molded me. I am the youngest of four brothers, and I have a little sister that's 7 years, 7 days, and seven grades beneath me. That's kind of the world. I'm a Trading Places, A-Team, Knight Rider, Rocky, Rambo. Type of dude. That's the world that I was raised in. He-Man, G.I. Joe, Transformers. That's my world, man. And that's the world that helped me to understand who I, what it meant to be a man. You know, I came along during the time, and you can attest, and I'm interested in hearing, your world as well, because I know I was very similar. But I came along during the time where it was just commonplace to be homophobic and to be chauvinistic and just to say things about women. Anytime a man was weak or anytime a man, failed at whatever task he put forward or was, too afraid to pursue something, we ascribe some feminine trait to him. Something that is typically, described, reserved for women. And that's just the world. And so that's how I grew up. I just thought that was natural. That was reinforced in my community. Even the older men really encouraged us to be promiscuous, telling us, you got to keep a woman in check. You got to get her in line. Sometimes you got to slap her from time to, these are type of things that were actually said in our community. Sometimes you got to pop her, get her in line. Don't let your woman, talk back to you and all these type of things. Just so many. So I was bombarded. And last thing I'll say is I remember there's a Clint Eastwood movie where he and a lady were kind of, at odds with each other. And there was a lot of tension between them. And if I remember the movie correctly, he slaps the woman. And then the two of them, after he slaps her, ends up kissing and having a sexual rendezvous in a barn. And that was just kind of like, that was the world. The world that said, if you really, a macho man knows how to control a woman. A macho man knows how to sexually exploit a woman, knows how to seduce a woman. That's just the world that I was born into. A macho man runs the world and women are there to gratify their needs, to feed them and to be their trophies. And that was just, and I didn't think anything of that. I'm curious, I'm from DC, you're from KC. What was your world like?
Yeah, I mean, similar to you, my parents divorced when I was a year. I was raised for the first, I think, 5 or 6 years of my life between my mother and my grandmother. My mother put herself through nursing school. And I remember her leaving me with my grandmother because she had said that she just couldn't study with me around. So she actually had to move into the dorm. And so there were times when I just didn't see my mother for, I don't know how long it was, you know, your perception of time when you're that young can be, pretty warped. But being raised by my grandmother I had seen and been around very strong, independent women, but like you, I grew up in the inner city. I was thinking about this the other day. We were putting this show together. I think there were at any given time 12 or more boys on my block where I lived. So we always had enough guys to play, you know, football, full on 11 on 11 or 5 on 5, however many we needed to play football. Yeah. We could play baseball. We could play
permanent basketball. Quarterback.
Yeah, we always had enough to play 5-on-5 basketball and to have people waiting to call game. You know, That's we just always had enough, and it was all boys. And so, like you said, there was anytime somebody fell down and started crying, they were soft, they were crying like a little girl. Anytime one of the guys didn't feel like playing, you know, come on, man, come on, let's play football. I don't feel like playing. Oh, you're the P word. You're acting like a little B. You know, this is the way that
F word and all that stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. It was a homophobic tropes. It was all of that kind of stuff. That was just the way, you know, you had to be tough. You had to dust, you fell down and got hurt. You had to put some dirt on it and walk it off. That kind of thinking, you know, if you were celebrated, if you sustained an injury that everyone acknowledged was worthy enough to draw tears and you didn't cry, you were legendary. So for instance, if we used to play, we would have the street and then you'd have kind of the sidewalk, but in between the sidewalk, you'd have like a strip of grass. So we would play, you know, two-hand touch on the street, tackle in the grass. So if you made it to the grass, you had it was open season, you could be tackled. But this strip of grass was very, very small, you know, and nobody was a professional football player able to, you know, effect precise tackling. You know, anyway, there were many times when once you got tackled, a significant part of your body would end up hitting a curb, the sidewalk, or the street.
Yeah.
And if your head bounced off of that and made the appropriate sound that drew a bunch of oohs and caused everybody to stop in their tracks, and you could hold your head, grit it, and not cry, man, you were just legendary. I mean, you were considered legendary. Those kinds of things. You know, you always had to be tough. That kind of stuff. And, you know, like you said, whenever we had any kind of experience with, I remember this specifically, if either of us had a girlfriend, if we showed any kind of emotion in the sense that we needed to spend time with the girlfriend, or we want to spend time with this girl, you know, we were made fun of. Oh, you're in love. Oh, you're a big punk. Oh, she's got you all this and this. And so there was never any kind of encouragement to develop a healthy kind of interaction with the opposite sex. It was always you were supposed to keep your emotions in check. You were not supposed to let it show or this person control you. A lot of the guys in my neighborhood didn't have dads, but they did have uncles around and like you said, older men around who
and the winos, you know, this is back in the days when we actually had real legitimate winos who hung out in front of liquor stores. You had the winos that used to hang out in front of the liquor stores that were doling out relationship and sex ed training.
Yes. 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 Unsolicited, you know, unrequested. I would calling it knowledge is just a slap in the face to anyone who has any kind of brains. But yes, you're right. So all of my learning, what I learned about how to treat women. And even in my household, it was very chauvinistic, very machismo. You know, when we weren't on the streets, like you said, we were watching television. We were seeing women get slapped. We were seeing women get dominated. We were seeing women get put in their place. You know, I was a big fan, as you are, of wrestling. You know, we watched wrestling all the time. And, you know, it was just men beating up on each other and, you know, flying around the ring and trash talking and, you know, being tough. And that's the environment that we grew up in. So you could imagine that when we were unleashed upon the world in a professional setting as adults, we weren't really ready to interact with a civilized society for the most part.
Yeah.
Okay. So let me ask you this. So how did your family impact the way you understood what it meant to be a man and the role of a woman? We hit a little bit on that, but let's dive a little more into that.
Yeah. And this is so important. Men teach men how to treat women. And so by not having a father in my home, I had to rely on my mom and the best advice that she can give, And I'm going to say this unapologetically. Men make men and women make women. And so when you talk about, you know, it's just natural. And so I didn't have a man to really show me. And I think that's the greatest thing. And then I had uncles. But like I said, my uncles, and as you alluded to earlier, my uncles would kind of just give you that flippant advice on relationships, you know, little stuff like, have you hit that yet? Well, this is stuff my uncles would say, have you hit that yet? Oh, you couldn't handle that. You know, all that kind of talking about, you know, whether or not I could conquer a woman, not even a woman, a girl sexually, you know, or you couldn't handle that. And so that was kind of, you know, that was the thing. Then I had older brothers, you know, and so they would have. Find X-rated at that time it was VHS tapes or Betamax tapes, and then you know they tell me, come on, sit down and watch this. And so that's kind of like, and then you know all the guys in the neighborhood would all gather around. It's not like now when you can watch it on your phone. You know, you'd have 10 dudes piled up in somebody's house watching pornographic movies. But not having that, you know, and I'm not criticizing that per se, that's just you know, children being children, teenagers being teenagers. But not having a male figure in the home to offset that was the biggest challenge. So I had to rely on, you know, certain things to kind of tell me what it was. And again, media, pop culture, guys in the neighborhood, the older guys in the neighborhood. You know, you never thought to yourself, this guy is a dysfunction. He's not even a functional alcoholic. He's a dysfunctional alcoholic. What advice could he possibly give me about life? But, you know, they would say things and it would just sound so good. And I just give you one example. I know it's deeper than just the sexualization part, but I'll just give you one example. I remember there was one guy in our neighborhood who, like I said, he lived in front of the liquor store, you know, bum change. He would bum 25 cents, whatever, till he got up to enough to buy a pint of some of the cheapest stuff. That was just the Odessa vodka to just tear the lining of your stomach out. And one day he was saying to me, and me and a couple other boys, he said, you see when those girls be shaking their leg, you know how people just nervously, without even thinking about it, just kind of jiggle their leg. I do it. Everybody does it. It never dawned on me, hey, you do it all the time. And then he said, you know, that's a girl letting you know, man, that she's hot. And, you know, for years, that just made perfect good sense to me. So I remember going back to school, like in the fourth or fifth grade, and just observing all the little girls who were shaking their legs and being like, wow, man, I have hit the jackpot. But I didn't hit the jackpot because that's not the message that they were sending. So not having that strong male role model is a serious challenge when a young man is trying to understand, how do I value, how do I treat women? You know, I know your situation was different because you had a stepfather in the home. So I'm interested in how that impacted your life.
Yeah, probably around five or I was about six or so, my mother remarried. And, you know, of course, I mean, we grew up, we were born in the 70s. He was born in the 50s. So, you know, you can imagine, you can imagine his thinking on women. But my mom was a professional. I mean, we were a two working parent household. I was definitely a latchkey kid. And a free range kid. I look back and wish my mom had asked me, you know, where have you been today? Because I think if I had given any indication of where I'd been, she would have been like, I cannot let that continue.
Rode your bikes to Topeka? What?
Yeah. It was a lot of that, man. Like hoarding, you know, bands of just young kids who should not have been off of their away from their own block or out of their home. At any rate, I mean, I grew up in a home like that. There was a lot of wholesomeness to it. My grandparent, his parents lived on the next block over, and my grandfather was a Baptist minister, and so you really had a sense of this kind of traditional, kind of household. You know, the wife was she actually was a teacher, so she didn't stay home, but they were both retired by this time. My grandmother, my stepfather's mother. But, you know, what I got from them, honestly, though, and I think you got this from your grandparents as well, is despite being around all of that kind of toxic environment of, you know, the alcoholics, the pimps and the, you know, the people who were out there on the streets kind of influencing our lives. My grandfather was a perfect gentleman and my grandmother was a perfect lady. I mean, I did get a lot from them, spending time with them, because I would go after school or before school in the morning when my parents would go to work, I would go and stay. I would get up in the morning and I would go walk down to their house and wait there until school started. They would feed me breakfast. I would watch a little bit of cartoons in the morning and then be on my way to school. And the same thing after school, I would go there in the after school and spend time with them. And yeah, he basically instilled in me what little bit that he could, how to be a gentleman, how to be respectful, how to be how to demonstrate some acts of chivalry when you could, how to be thoughtful and considerate. So a lot of those things were kind of put in there, but those things didn't translate well on the streets with my friends, you know. So that was kind of a secret life that I had. I had some of that instilled in me, but I could not let that show in front of my friends.
As I think about with my grandfather and grandmother, who also a very traditional home, and you know, they showed that marriage does work. One of the things that happened though is because of the overwhelming influence of media and the community, you know, I thought to myself, that's because my grandfather's from the World War II era. My grandfather fought in World War II. So I justified his behavior as being that generation. But, you know, the women of today, you know, that's the same way you kind of hear people talk about now, you know, these 304s today ain't made like they were back in the 60s and whatnot. You know, but the reality of the matter is humans are humans, whether it's the 60s, 50s, 40s or whatever. But I didn't appreciate that because of the counter narrative that was being poured in. It wasn't until I, you know, began to form my own family that I started to appreciate what I got from my grandparents. Sorry to cut you off, but that just jumped in my mind.
No. I think that's a good way of realizing that is that there's all of this dissonance and contradictions in what is being poured into us. And the crazy thing is that I was actually at a seminar the other day yesterday at my children's school. A guest speaker came in and talked about resilience and empathy for what we call third culture kids, and how the pandemic affected that, and how it can be a struggle to develop empathy and resilience when you're being raised outside of your what we call passport holding home country. And for those who don't know, my family and I, we live in Singapore. So our kids are what they consider third culture kids. But at any rate, one of the things that jumped out at me that he talked about was how our kids are just inundated with media. You know, while we had media influence, while there were things that we would see, like the speaker said yesterday, you know, when you wanted to watch the news was a show. It was a show that came on at a certain time. And if you missed it, you missed it. That was it. There was no rewind. There was no catch some clips later on YouTube. There was none of that. It came on at that time. If you were there to see it, you saw it. If you weren't, you missed it. That was it. And you read the newspaper, you know, that kind of thing. Right. So we, even though we had we did have these influences with media. I mean, we came up, you know, during the peak James Bond era. I mean,
I forgot about James Bond.
I mean, peak, the Roger Moore era. That guy made it with more women in one movie, man, than probably could be humanly possible. And drank enough vodka that, I mean, his liver should have been shot after the first 8 minutes of the movie. But at any rate, you know, that's what we did see these things, but these were, you know, we weren't inundated with it. And today's kids now are just completely inundated with all kinds of images and poured in. But you said something in your comment about, you know, it wasn't until you got older and started your own family that you realized where these things were wrong. Let's talk about that. So when did you first realize that you were wrong in the way that you were taught to view and understand women?
Yeah. Having daughters will change your perspective on the world. Having daughters will change it. But even before that, I'll be honest with you, I started to have an awakening when I was in college. That's when I gave my heart to Jesus Christ and became a born again Christian. And so I had, you know, I had that epiphany, that transformation, what we refer to as that worldly lifestyle. That's the lifestyle of someone who, you know, has no spiritual foundation and no, you know, no thought of morality, you know, no real contemplation of morality. And so it was one of the awakening moments. But then having a daughter, you know, when you have a daughter, you realize so many things. Like, for instance, when you have a daughter, you just don't want your daughter sitting in guys' laps. Something you would never even think about. You know, when you have a daughter, you keep your eye on people that interact with her, especially when she's younger. You know, you're very cautious about whose house they spend the night over. And especially if there's a man involved in it, you know, you're just really, really protective. And so that's when a lot of the ideas that I had about the role and purpose of women began to be challenged as I thought about, okay, you know, if that's true, then how does that apply to my daughter? If that is true, then what does that mean for the life of my child? When she becomes an adult and enters into the world, will men think of her in that way? So, you know, it kind of sobered up quick. As drunk as I was with the world, that kind of sobered me up pretty quick. And then, as you know, I was a single father. So that's when I realized that a lot of the views that women were, and I'm just going to put it in language, the view that women were less than really, you know, really came into perspective. You know, chauvinism is the equivalent of racism, in that it just presupposes that men are superior to women, not just different, but superior. And it puts women in somewhat of a childlike position. And I never, you know, I had you asked me this when I was 18, 17, 19 or 20 or whatever, I would have told you, no, I don't think that. But if you look at my actions and my behavior, that's exactly what I thought. So that was, you know, that was something.
Yeah, you know, it's very interesting because you talk about how having a daughter really changed that. It's interesting because I'm sure the people who gave you and gave me advice about women and how to treat them, they all had a mom, right? They all had a grandma. Mm-hmm. They all probably had sisters, and some of them had daughters. But it just seems like when you're in that ecosystem, kind of that closed ecosystem, where if you try to change your behavior or your thoughts or your way of viewing, you're really I mean, you're really just hitting your head up against the wall, exactly. Right? You're not. So you had the opportunity to be out of that environment and raise your daughter in the sense, I mean, the environment that you grew up in.
Yeah.
I think that is a way to kind of get free. And it's the same thing with me. When I had my children, I wasn't living in the same neighborhood. I wasn't being influenced or having conversations with the same people. My daughters didn't have to grow up in the neighborhood that I grew up in. So I wonder if I would have just, you know, given up to the system and just been like, man, you know what? You're a girl, you know, in this neighborhood, in this world, you'll probably be pregnant at 15. You'll probably be, you know, this will probably just be the life that is your life because, you know, there's no other way. And even though as a dad, I don't want to see that. I don't want that to happen to you. What else can we do?
Yeah. And then it becomes kind of just, I don't want nobody to dog my daughter out. I'm just not going to let no dude beat on her or just, you know, or just completely dog her out. But hey,
yeah.
You know, she's going to have these experiences. This is just,
yeah,
this is just
she's got to go to the yeah, she's going to go to the same schools. She's going to go to the, you know, she's going to be interacting. And that's just the way it's going to be. She's going to be a victim of the values that are, you know, that are a part of that environment. I think we both are very fortunate in that way that we could kind of get clear of that environment. And then when we had daughters, be able to, you know, really be able to process the way that we think or the way that we thought about women.
Yeah.
Because, you know, yeah, the same thing. I think the same thing that happened with me. Did you have anything else you wanted to say, or did you?
Yeah, I wanted to say one more thing. And just talking about, you know, you had a mother, you had a grandmother, you had sisters, aunts, cousins, all of that stuff. You know, that's one of the things when I try to help people to understand white supremacy, you know, that I bring up is that, yes, you can have all of these things and still hold some the idea that because you are white, you're superior to. So, yes, I do have a black granddaughter. And yes, I do have black friends. And yes, I do have black neighbors and church members and people I interact with. But that still doesn't change the idea that I am better than them. And so, you know, the understanding was that my mother is older and responsible for me. But just as a man, I'm still a man. I am still a man and she is still a woman. And it's kind of just tucked in the back of the psyche until we become honest and really think about it. I know we'll talk about this a little bit later, but until we really bring it to the forefront. So just having women in your life does not stop you. You know, we've seen celebrities and famous politicians who have daughters and wives and moms who say some of the most gross and disgusting, who do some of the most disgusting things, you know, in and out of the Oval Office at the White House. You know, so just having those people that you're connected to by family lineage doesn't mean that that impacts the way you think and view women.
Yeah. I agree. I think for me, and I'll answer this part of it, and then we'll wrap it up. I think for me, what changed, you know, you have this idea of you've talked about this when you said I'm a man, right? We have this idea as men that there should be very distinct and specific roles in what a man should do and not do, and what a woman should do and not do, and that causes all sorts of problems when you're trying to move your family ahead to be successful. And I'll explain what I mean by that. What changed for me, as you said, going to college, interacting with women in professional settings, realizing that, you know, this is not an acceptable way to think. But again, you know, that's the only way I've been kind of taught to think. It's really difficult. And when you start to have this awakening, you realize, oh my gosh, this is awful. The way that I'm thinking and what I'm doing looking on the other side of that, thinking, you know, what is this? What is the woman on the other end of this experiencing from me? Mm. And like you said, it's difficult. You don't want to admit that you're wrong. You don't want to admit that you are doing something wrong because your intention is not that. You think that you're a good, you're a good person. I mean, I was a good person, no doubt about it. But both things could be true. I could be a good person with very poor skill sets. I could be a good person with good intentions, with very bad actions. And so as I grew up, and like I said, as I went to college, got into professional settings and all this kind of thing. But once I got married, and my wife and I started our family, we realized that in order for our family to be successful, the way that we wanted to be successful, these ideas of roles, what the man's role and what the woman's role, had to kind of be obliterated. And what we realized was that what our marriage needs, what our family needs, are two adults. We don't need a man and a woman. We don't need the role of a man or the role of a woman. We need two adults, meaning if something needs to be cooked and prepared for the kids, wherever the adult just needs to do it. If someone has a better opportunity professionally and has a better opportunity to grow in their profession, then that adult is the one that should be given and afforded that opportunity. It doesn't matter what their gender is.
Exactly.
And that's what happened with me and my family. My wife had more opportunities. I would say she is smarter than me. I will admit that. I don't think that means that all women are smarter than all men, but in this case, this woman is definitely smarter than this man. but she, she came up in a different background. There was an expectation for her to excel professionally, while as that was not the expectation for me. So from the beginning, academically, college, all of these things, that just came natural for her. It was expected. So when she got into the workforce, she started to, she started to grow and become more and more successful. So at any rate, what happened was when we had our first child, we decided, hey, we want one parent to be home. Yes. And at that point, we weren't going to think about whose role was what. She had the potential to go further in her career at the time than I did. Why in the world would we take a pay cut and make her stay home and me to go to work just because I'm the man? I stayed home. That's what I did. Stayed home with both of my daughters. And that really gave me a sense of, how limiting the idea of chauvinism can be. It limited everything. It would have taken away a wonderful experience that I had to be able to raise my children. I mean, I would have lost that opportunity. Instead, I got something. I gained an experience that is probably the thing that I point to when I say I'm the most proud of, and the thing that has had the most meaning to me in my life, has been able to be with my daughters, before they went off to school.
Yeah, and I believe very much, and then I want to share just about another thing that helped me along in this journey. But I believe very much in well-defined roles in families. Mm-hmm. I do believe that. But I believe that families need to sit down and decide what those roles are. So I don't think that is a one-size-fits-all cookie cutter. But I think that families, husbands and wives, parents, need to be clear in their communication with one another about what, who does what and how does this, that, and the other is taken care of and get accomplished. But to say that this is, the man has to be the one that goes out of the house, the woman has to be the one that stays home, is just not realistic in this day and age. But also, again, because how human relationships are so dynamic, it just doesn't work. One of the things that I wanted to say, and I really appreciate you being candid about that. One of the things I wanted to say when we talk about what was my journey towards overcoming toxic male chauvinism is that, since I was 17 years old, I have been actively engaged, not always in the most constructive ways and not always in the most effective ways, but I have been committed to overthrowing white supremacy. Mm. I believe that white supremacy is, as Malcolm X put it, is a malignant cancer that is in the body of America. I believe that white supremacy is not only in white people, but it's also in black people. I believe there are a lot of black people who suffer from the idea that just by being white, you are superior. That's all white supremacy is that they are superior to us. Their schools are superior. Their institutions are superior. They're more intelligent, all these other things. You know, white people's ice is colder. Their water is wetter. And so I've been really on a journey to for years to identify where white supremacy exists in my own life, and then where it exists, you know, and then where it exists in our world, and how can I tackle and destroy it. And so after the George Floyd murder, I was getting a lot of calls to do presentations and to have conversations about, you know, implicit bias, white supremacy, you know, all those different conversations that were happening back then, which have just died now because, you know, it is what it is. People weren't really serious. They were just guilty. But with that being said, one of the things that I realized was that there was a parallel. And even though I was trying to make very small incremental changes, one of the things that accelerated it was when I realized that the same struggle that someone who was born in the United States of America, who is white, how they are told from day one, you know, whether they're at church reading the religious books and everything is European, whether they are at school and everything is European, whether they're it's just looking at magazines and beauty and everything is European, I realized, man, this is a big struggle. You've been told your whole life that white is supreme. It is superior. And I said, man, that is very similar to what I've been trying to deal with in my own life around my views toward women. And that was something that was an impetus that really pushed me to become more intentional in my thinking and my self-examination and in trying to chart a course. So I was moving, but I think the murder of George Floyd and all the conversations that happened around that really said, hey, Robert, if you're going to talk about white supremacy, have you dealt with the cancer that is inside of you? Now, you're black, so you're not going to be able to do the white supremacy thing. But what about the chauvinism thing? Have you been to the doctor to get that cancer taken care of? And so that was really what moved me in my journey to say, I've got to overcome this. And so one of the things that I'm very intentional about doing now is surrounding myself with strong, progressive women who will call me out when I you know, when I make mistakes, and I still make mistakes. I am not perfect. Just the other day, we were having a community meeting. There are 17 people running for mayor. I believe the majority of the people running for mayor are women here in Denver. And I was talking about the election. And I said, when the next mayor is elected, he, and I just said he and kept on talking like it was nothing. And a woman called me to, she said, Robert, you said he, and I was wrong. I still struggle with it. Like I said, this is probably one of the things that's going to come back to haunt me when I try to become the chair of the United Nations, is this statement here. I said he, which means then that there are still blind spots that I need to work on. And someone had to call me out and say, no, you have to use inclusive language, he or she. You can't just say he. And I couldn't argue with that. I apologized because I was wrong. But it just reminded me. But I need people like that around me, people that will remind me, listen, I know that you're on this journey and this is where you're messing up. I need those type of coaches, those type of accountability partners in my life. And fortunately, I have surrounded myself with women like that. And I've made it so that I'm open to learn and to grow and hopefully to become better. It's a slow, arduous process because I've got so much garbage that is in there, and getting all that junk out is difficult, but I'm on this journey. And I'm enjoying it, man. And I'm hoping that I'm becoming a better person.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. And I think we can leave it there and pick this up in part two of the broadcast, because I think we're getting into that question of how we actually have atoned, and you know, the things that we're doing to try to make. You know, to try to make ourselves better and to try to do better in society. You know, so we'll pick that question up in part two. But for now, we'll leave it with that. Thanks again. I want to thank Robert again for his candor and his knowledge and wisdom. I think this has been a very productive a very productive show, at least for us. And I hope that the listeners out there have taken something away from that. So with that, we will bid you adieu until our next show. Thank you for joining us once again. Be well.
Unbox provides a full-service leaders peer support community that helps high-level leaders become more authentic leaders who build healthy workplace cultures and reach their personal life goals. To learn more and discover how we can take your leadership and your life to the next level, please visit our website at unboxtolead.com. That's unboxed, the number 2, lead.com. Again, that's unboxed, the number 2, to lead.com.